For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everybody, tonight we're debating whether or not the police are systematically racist, and we're starting right now with Jangles' opening statement. Thanks so much for being with us, Jangles. The floor is all yours.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. So I go by Justin. I have a YouTube channel called Jangles Science Side, where I go over the science behind social issues and comedy, because I hate jokes and I never want you to laugh. So, all right, let's get right into it. I wrote my opening statement like a nerd, so, you know, what better way to endear myself than sound like a robot right out the gate? Cool. All right. So proving systemic racism, whether we're talking about the criminal justice system or any other institution, does not mean proving that all or most or even some of the members of that institution are explicitly or implicitly biased. Rather, it's about showcasing how the systems themselves operate to perpetuate disparity and inequality, how history influences procedures that produce outcomes that inform procedures that produce more outcomes. Systemic racism perpetuates racial inequalities regardless of bias, which is not to say that the people operating within them are not influenced by biases of either past or present biases. So let's start with facts all of us can agree on. So my primary source for this entire opening statement is the 2015 report from the Sentencing Project, which would later be given to the United Nations. So the United States has the largest criminal justice system in the world, with nearly 7 million individuals under some sort of correctional control at year-end 2015, including more than 2 million in federal, state, or local prisons and jails. Black people are about 5 times as likely as their white counterparts to be arrested for a crime during their lifetime, with 1 in 3 Black men born in 2001 likely to go to prison at some point, compared to 1 in 17 white men if current trends continue, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. Black people comprise a disproportionately high percentage of arrests, being 13% of the population, but making up 39% of the arrests for violent crimes and 29% of the arrests for property crimes, with additional data gathered that seems to point to these being fairly accurate estimations of people who actually commit those crimes. Black and Hispanic people in the United States do commit more crime than white people, and this is largely explanatory for the racial disparity in the prison population. However, there are still very important reasons to believe that systemic racism is still at play in the criminal justice system. Not all of the racial disparities in the prison population can be explained by crime rates alone. A ton of studies conducted by the criminal justice scholars that I have in my notes here point to actual crimes committed accounting for only between about 61 and 80% of Black overrepresentation in prison, with the remaining percentage being something else. There are more factors at play here, and disregarding race and history as a factor in this disparity would constitute an incomplete analysis. One, for example, there are disparate racial impacts of ostensibly race-neutral policies and laws. High crime rate areas attract more policing, which will catch more crime in high rate, crime rate areas. An example would be the vast discrepancy in arrests for marijuana between Black and white individuals, despite similar usage rates. Additionally, sentencing laws may take into account factors like school zones that result in harsher sentences for the same crime that disproportionately affects areas with high urban density simply by way of geographic location. So same crime, if it's caught in the a place that is close to a school because of school zoning laws, it'll result in a harsher sentencing, and that's regardless of the crime produced. And I don't think I have to say that like people, Black people are more likely to live in concentrated urban areas. Two, I also believe that it's pretty unlikely that the human beings employed as police officers and prosecutors and judges are entirely free from prejudice. There's a narrative that overt forms of prejudice, like those of the Jim Crow era, have fallen away in favor of more unconscious forms of bias, which is certainly true in a way, but I think that this implies a direct link when there may not be one. If you grew up being taught that prejudice is wrong and a thing of the past, but still see these racial disparities resulting from colorblind laws, you, in your capacity as a police officer or judge, might develop a sort of post hoc justification for differential racial treatment. Experimental research shows that citizens and police officers alike are more likely to treat darker suspects more harshly. Overworked defense attorneys may exhibit racial bias in how they triage their heavy caseloads, and judges are more likely to sentence people of color to longer sentences even after accounting for differences in crime severity and criminal history. In fact, the less severe the offense, the more discretion the judge has, the more likely they are to give those harsher sentences, because young Black men in particular are perceived as being more dangerous than their white counterparts. Three, we must also take the self-perpetuating cycles of poverty into account. Black people are more likely to be poor, poor people are more likely to be treated unfairly in the criminal justice system, and criminals are then more likely to be poor. Low-income people have less access to quality legal teams and are more likely to be detained prior to conviction, which themselves correlate with harsher convictions and less favorable plea deals. Poor people are subject to harsher risk assessments that punish them for not having access to employment or transportation, and alternative treatment options involve either expensive rehab programs they can't afford or publicly funded treatment options that are woefully inadequate. Four, and finally, we have to discuss how the system perpetuates itself. The criminal justice system is an institution that primarily reacts to, rather than prevents, crime, and it's seen in the public eye as our best approach to the issue of crime. When a politician declares themselves tough on crime in order to gain popularity, something that has historically been quite effective in getting votes, they always mean harsher punishments for criminals rather than addressing the lack of opportunities that drive the vast majority of street crime in the first place. There is a hostility and demonization of even petty criminals in the United States that basically ensure that a segment of the population are guaranteed to be trapped in a vicious cycle. Most people released from prison end up back in it because most other options to live a normal life have been stripped away. And since contributing to those other options would be seen as soft on crime, they have been historically unpopular. Those four features, the disparate racial impact of ostensibly race-neutral policies and laws, racial bias among criminal justice professionals, resource allocation decisions that disadvantage low-income people, and criminal justice policies that exacerbate socioeconomic inequalities, those are what constitute systemic racism on the part of the criminal justice system in the United States. And only one of them actually involves anything close to what most people would consider racist actions. Systemic racism is not simply police officers killing unarmed Black men because they are racist. Systemic racism is angry white union members decreasing their support for the public safety net when colored people were brought to the table by Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, viewing public resources as a zero-sum game that necessitated competition and justification for viewing Black people as less deserving, leading to fewer legitimate opportunities for economic and social mobility for people of color, and a damaged view of American politics and law being seen as for the benefit of someone else if you were not white. It's history influencing policy that produces outcomes that further influence policy. The acceptance of systemic racism is an answer to a binary question. Can these racial disparities be addressed, or are they innate? Are they the result of policies, past and present, or are they biology manifesting itself in society? I contend that they are the result of policy and that they can be addressed politically, which falls in line with the current scientific literature on race that recognizes race as a political label rather than a genetic one. Whether it's revising policies and laws with disparate racial impacts, addressing implicit racial bias among criminal justice professionals, reallocating resources to create a fair playing field, or revising policies that exacerbate socioeconomic inequalities to redirect public spending toward crime prevention and drug treatment, addressing systemic racism is a political solution to a political problem, and it offers the best way forward for all of us.
You got it. Thank you very much, Jangles, for that opening statement. And want to let you know, folks, if it's your first time here at Modern Day Debate, we are a neutral platform hosting debates on science, religion, and politics. And we want to let you know, we hope you feel welcome no matter what walk of life you are from, no matter where you are on the political spectrum. With that, we're going to kick it over to Sean Last. Thanks so much. The floor is all yours, Sean.
All righty. I also wrote out an opening statement. I conceived the topic a little more narrowly than Jangles did, as will be evident. Part of me wants to try to change it live on the spot as I read it, but I will resist the temptation to do that. So anyway, when I say that the criminal justice system is not systematically racist, what I primarily mean by that is that Black and white people who act in the same way are generally either going to be treated the same way, or in fact that the criminal justice system will tend to treat the Black people better. Saying that Black people get treated worse by the criminal justice system because they act worse, maybe denying that systemic racism exists, or depending on how you want to define it, that may be in fact just defending its existence. But that's sort of besides the point. I'd like to focus on the empirical substance of this and not the semantics. Now, in a way, it's inherently difficult to refute the view that I've laid out because the variables used in criminology are typically very vague, too vague to exactly match behavior. So, for instance, many papers will control for quote-unquote criminal history in a way that equates to people who have the same number of previous convictions, regardless of what those convictions were. Or even when they compare more narrow categories of conviction, they run into problems like, for instance, the fact that there's a lot of variation within the category of quote-unquote assault. But even using these sorts of vague metrics, a lot has been shown to be not due to bias, which we might otherwise think would be. So, for instance, it's been shown that the rate at which police stop people in their cars seems to be pretty equal once you control for driving behavior and the like, that if you compare the rate at which people call the police on members of different races to the rate at which they're arrested for crimes of victims, that those arrest rates match those police report rates, that the incarceration rates in turn match the arrest rates, and setting the arrest rates aside, you can just control for psychological measures like IQ and general violence, and that this reduces to insignificance the racial difference in incarceration rates. That even though most of the literature does show that there's a racial difference in the propensity to be the subject of force being used by police, that meta-analytically this has been shown to be just due to publication bias, and that removing that publication bias reduces that effect to insignificance. At the rate at which Black people are killed by police roughly matches, or actually is not as high as the rate at which they engage in potentially fatal action against police officers, that comparing sufficiently similar crimes makes it so that the difference in sentence length goes away, et cetera. So that a lot of this stuff, I think, even using the sort of metrics that we have, can just be accounted for. And I think we'll probably end up talking about a few of those. You can also try to exactly match behavior in a way that these variables can't by creating artificial situations. But this, of course, will lead to justified skepticism about the generalizability of the results to the real world. So, for instance, there's simulation training, and in that training, police officers are more reluctant to shoot a suspect when they're Black. And generally speaking, these sorts of experimental tests of racial bias in behavior, as opposed to a kind of implicit bias, but an actual behavioral bias, tend to find that white Americans exhibit no net bias. These two lines of evidence, broad lines of evidence that I've laid out, imperfect as they are, I think are important for interpreting situations where we don't know what the answer is. So to take two examples. So one example has to do with drugs. Now, people talk a lot about the fact that Black people in surveys say that they use drugs at about the same rate that white people do, and yet are arrested a lot more for drug crime. And there are a few things you can say about that. You can say that we know by drug testing people, the Black people are more likely than white people to lie about that, and so that those results are not valid. We also know that Black people are more likely to do various things like buy drugs from strangers, buy drugs outside, et cetera, which put them at a higher risk of being arrested. But we don't have data exactly showing that Black and white drug users who act the exact same way will have the exact same propensity to be arrested. So how should we interpret that? Well, my view is that we should have a sort of default presumption against a racial bias explanation if we know that this same system involving these same police officers exhibits no racial bias in a bunch of other contexts. To take another example that I think might be relevant, we don't know for sure why it is that Black people are pulled over more when the light goes down, that is when the sun goes down, when there's literally less light. We know that generally speaking, you can go in and, for instance, with a camera, measure how much people are speeding, and once you control for that, there is no racial difference in the propensity to be stopped, but we don't know exactly why it is that when there's less light out, Black people are less likely to be pulled over. And by process of elimination, we might say that, well, there's only a few explanations possible that are left. So for the sake of argument, let's say that it's either racial bias or the fact that Black people are overrepresented among criminal suspects, and so get pulled over more when they can be seen to match those suspects. Now, in a vacuum, there's no reason to prefer either of these explanations. And if they were exhaustive, they would each have a 50% chance of being true. But the knowledge, again, that the same system is unbiased in other contexts decreases the probability of that racism explanation as the correct explanation relative to this other explanation, or really any other explanation. And the same sort of reasoning can be applied in various other contexts in which we don't yet have full models that totally explain racial disparities in outcome. The final thing that I want to talk about has something to do with falsifiability. Because sometimes when you talk about stuff like this, and I make the kinds of arguments that I've already made, someone on the left will accuse me of having an impossible bar of evidence. And I think this accusation is wrongheaded for many reasons. But one that I think deserves special attention that I want to talk about here is slightly a little bit technical. And that's why I want to talk about it here in the opening. So when you build a statistical model predicting something like whether someone will be arrested, part of your output tells you how much of the difference is between people in whether they will be arrested is predictable on the basis of that model. And that's just called the proportion of variance the model explains. And generally speaking, models used to demonstrate racial bias, often cited in criminology literature, the leftists like to point to, they often explain something like 30% of the variance in the outcome being looked at. Now, given this, it is not a mere matter of speculation, but demonstrable fact that these models have failed to account for the variables which explain the vast majority of the variance in the outcome, despite already including traditional measures of things like offense severity, criminal history, race, et cetera. And so to think that they've narrowed the space of possible explanations so much that we are justified in inferring that there's probably no missing variable from our model, which might explain the significance that the model is attributing to race, is, I think, pretty silly. And I think I'm going to stop it there. I didn't realize until just a few hours ago that this was supposed to be 12 minutes long, and I have not actually added enough to it yet to make it be anywhere near 12 minutes long. I don't think so. I'll just stop there.
You got it. Well, no problemo. And we're going to jump into open discussion, but also want to let you know, folks, as mentioned, we have many juicy debates on science, religion, and politics. Hit that subscribe button if you haven't already, as we have many more to come. And with that, thanks, gentlemen. The floor is all yours for that open dialogue.
So two big things. There's like, you know, both of us listed about 20 different points in our opening statements. So I don't think it's reasonable for both of us to like go point by point. But there's two major ones that I want to address from yours. One is that one of the things I said is that racial disparity alone, or like racial bias alone, could not be explanatory of most of the racial disparity in arrests. I even conceded that the rate of arrests pretty closely matched the rate of actual offenses perpetrated. So I'm not saying that racial bias is the racial bias on the part of the police officer is the primary determinant of the racial disparities in the criminal justice system. But if it is any factor at all, it's worth considering. All right. Even as, and I'm not accusing you of anything, even as someone who believes in the biological reality of race, you probably wouldn't want messy data. You probably wouldn't want bias interfering with the arrest records when it comes to arrests. So yeah, the more interesting question is, and the one that I pose is the main factor in proving systemic racism, is that it doesn't have to have any bias within any individual actor at all. So I guess here's a question. Do you think that the historical inertia of objectively racist policies in America's past has some influence on the position of people of color today?
Okay, I want to say two things. So firstly, because I was listening to your opening statement, obviously, and if I recall correctly, you had said that you thought that the criminality explains something like, I think you said 60 to 80% of the overrepresentation in arrest rates, whereas I was saying that it
really
explains
close.
Something
really
like...
Close. It's 60 to 80% of the disparity can be explained by arrest rates. So really close, yeah.
Whereas I was saying that their actual behavior just explains the whole thing. So I do think there is a disagreement there. But as for the history question, I mean, it's kind of a vague, I'm sure that there is some way in which the history of racism in the United States impacts people today. But if you mean something like they were slaves and this instilled in them a pattern of not being able to accumulate wealth, and so they're poor today, and then this is why they're committing more crimes, something like that, then no, I tend to not believe in those sorts of things.
How come? Do you think poor people commit more or less crime than rich people, with all other variables being equal? Pretty correct. There's a pretty correct answer there.
Yeah. So I mean, there's a two. You see why there are two reasons. One is that seemingly poverty is not causal of crime, and secondly, the idea that your grandparents' level of wealth has a big effect on your current level of economic success also seems not true. So two different.
Well, Well, one, the second one, that's objectively true. All right, there's about six generations of effect from your from one generation's wealth. There's about six generations of wealth after that they're going to affect you. So, for example, if you're born into the bottom like quartile or quintile of wealth, it's very, very hard to get out of it. It's very like your upper mobility is much lower than someone born even in the second quintile of wealth. So it is very hard. If you're born into poverty, you're more likely to stay there. And likewise, if you're born with into wealthy parents, you're more likely to stay there. Just for the simple fact that you're going to have more resources available to you if you're wealthy that you wouldn't have access to if you're poor. There's also the issue of poverty might not be the explanatory on its own, but would you agree that rural poverty and urban poverty are two very different beasts?
So I think what we should do here is probably like just pick one of these things. Like let's do the and then do the other, not pick sure. one of these things and then not talk
which
about
one
it,
which one
we shouldn't which, keep doing two things at a time.
Oh, sure. So, well, I kind of rejected the notion that wealth is not generational. I kind of rejected that.
Right. So let's do that first. So there are a few things. So it's definitely true that people from poor families tend to end up poorer. But of course, you can then ask, why is that? And there's several different lines of evidence which I think suggest that it's not going to be primarily causal. And this would be a few different ways. So firstly, you can look at something like family income. And while it's true that in general, people from families of higher incomes tend to themselves have higher incomes, this is only true in biological families, that in adoptive studies, that correlation does not exist. In the second place, studies which try to look at what economists call random shocks to family wealth, where this is a change in family wealth that we know is not going to be, for instance, linked to, say, a culture or a genetic pattern in the family that lets them accumulate more wealth, something like the mass destruction of property via a war. Studies that look at these kind of random shocks to wealth tend to find that the effects of wealth on future generations' wealth, they don't last very long. So that if we're talking about the grandparents of someone, if, for instance, this is a particular famous study from looking at houses in Georgia, families in Georgia in the 1860s, asking the question, what was the result of the when people had their wealth there?
When you say Georgia, I'm sorry. War. I was going to say, which Georgia are you talking about? Okay, but the American Georgia, okay.
Yeah, and so there's a study, for instance, looking at what happened to the families who had their wealth destroyed there. Did that have an effect on the socioeconomic status of their descendants? The answer to that question was largely no. That's just one example. There are several different studies in this kind of literature.
But you would agree that like white families and black families after the Civil War were treated incredibly differently.
Sure, but the question we're teasing apart right now is whether or not there's a causal effect of, for instance, your grandparents' wealth on your wealth.
It's never going to be singularly causal. It's always going to be a part of a multitude of factors. Poor people often live in worse areas with less opportunity. And obviously, an area that is full of poor people probably doesn't have the kind of like employment opportunities or a good education system that is going to make it more conducive to economic mobility. So it's not singularly causal, but there's a lot of correlative factors that tend to go with poverty. You're probably not going to be born into poverty, but in a great neighborhood with great schools, correct?
Sure, but if you look at, so the point is though, that if we look at random changes in poverty and we find that these random changes don't lead to changes in the socioeconomic status of the descendants, that means that not only is it true that poverty inherently in itself doesn't cause these things, but anything that's going to reliably go with poverty, such as any of the things you're mentioning.
Okay, so based on the research that I've seen, that generally speaking, that it's very hard to apply like any sort of general statistic to any one individual, that poverty is pretty sticky. You're less likely to get out of poverty, and this also includes to like this is regardless of race. Like poor, if you're poor and white and born into rural Appalachia, you're more likely to stay poor, and obviously you're going to stay white, but you're more likely to stay poor than if you were born into a more wealthy family, even in the same relative geographical location, because you just have fewer opportunities. I don't see how it's a leap in logic to assume that if you go to a worse school and you have fewer economic opportunities to like get the kind of education or get the kind of health that you would need growing up, is going to affect you in multiple different ways, some of which are just purely like circumstantial, like you're not going to have access to the same like level of schooling or the same level of tutoring or the same level of like first jobs, because you're not going to have the same connections. Like your uncle's probably not going to be in a position where he can get you a good first job at like his local business or something like that. And also it's going to affect you psychologically. It's a lot harder to look at like long-term planning when you grow up in poverty, because that drastically affect your psychology, because there is no long-term planning. The only thing that matters is right now, because that's going to be the difference between like you eating and not eating is what you do in the next like 10 minutes. So yeah, you're going to buy the more expensive options because you can't buy the more expensive option in bulk.
So it's definitely true that poverty is sticky, but my view is that that's primarily because genes are sticky. You look at twin studies or more modern SNP heritability, and the heritability of, for instance, income is quite significant. So that it runs in families is not surprising from any perspective. And I understand the narrative that you're laying out, and I understand why that's a plausible hypothesis for sure. But if adoption data and random shock data, so, I mean, just an empirical question, right? How much do these things actually impact your income? And it seems to be that insofar as they are directly caused by poverty, the answer to that is close to none, at least if we're talking about a long run effect that will last multiple generations.
Okay, so I'm gonna have to look up the data on that. I'm skeptical of the idea that if a kid is adopted very young, especially very young into a wealthy family, that they wouldn't exhibit at least similar degrees of the same like benefits and or drawbacks that they would from just a purely generational variable of it. But I'm also kind of seeing where you're going with this. You're kind of putting forth a biological explanation for this, which is fine. You can do that. But then I would have to ask you, like, do you think that like biology and genealogy can like accurately place people into white and black? Or do you think that we're working backwards from white and black to use genealogy and genes to make explanatory effects that might not be viable?
Well, right now we're just talking about the effect of poverty on future income or wealth. And I don't think that directly ties into the genetics of race, but I mean, yeah, I think that race, you can predict race on genes. I mean, that's just a fact.
Okay. So do you think that we can like take genealogy and then we can create a white race and a black race?
So what would it mean to, quote, create a white race?
It would mean to say that there's a good justification for the separation of this one group of people based on their shared genes into a race that we would call white or black.
Have a justification. Now, whether or not it's a good justification, and this may sound a little weird. So for some context, because this is something, this has to do more with biology than it does race. So in the 1950s, there was a big debate in taxonomy, sometimes just called the subspecies debate. Because historically what happened in subspecies taxonomy, and this seems so far afield from the police, systemically racist, but whatever.
I know. To skip ahead a little bit, like we started with white and black and a bunch of other different races. And then we worked to justify classifications into those races. All right. You started with race, and then a lot of like genealogists and taxonomists post hoc justified why people ought to be placed into those races. They were from the beginning a political label to justify political power rather than a subsection of biology springing forth out of nowhere with the null hypothesis, putting people using biology, using genealogy into these races. All right, white, black, and whatever, like red, yellow, all those races were created first, and then we started to place people within them. All right, so I don't think... Okay, go ahead.
So I was just going to say that in the 50s, since the 50s, it's been widely recognized in subspecies taxonomy that if we're going to do subspecies, that choosing the correct set of subspecies within a given species is somewhat arbitrary and is going to be up to what the taxonomist thinks is socially important. That's what I was going to say. So that there's a mirroring here with race and subspecies taxonomy.
Well, of course,
race, like, not subspecies.
Yeah, and where are the taxonomists getting those ideas? They're getting them from the political structures and the social structures at the time.
So they're getting them from a variety of sources. But the point I was just making is that the fact that race is constructed in this way does not tell us whether or not there are significant biological differences. Now, I do want to also say, though, that I think the history of the formation of racial concepts is largely going to be based on people just noticing the clustering of geographical differences, at least as it seemed to them as they traveled around the globe, sort of in that 1500s, 1600s.
To skip a few steps and bring it back to like racial disparities in policing, what benefit does this give us? Like, if you look at a black person, do you think that there's enough biological difference between black, supposed black, and supposed white people to make an inference on their behavior? Do you think that that's a reasonable justification? If you see a black person.
Oh, I mean, sure.
All right, so you're not arguing against, systemically racist police officers or policing. You're justifying it. You're saying that since
I said that in my opening statement that I might, depending on how you define it, I might just be defending systemic racism rather than denying it exists. If it's just objectively rational, right? If your race is being used, so something that maybe this will clear it up. I would be opposed to, for instance, saying I'm going to treat this black person differently because I don't like the fact that they're black. But if you say I'm going to treat this black person differently because given the set of imperfect information I have, his race is just objectively a valid heuristic for some outcome that I have legitimate interest in, then I don't think that that's objectionable.
Okay, I definitely think that it's objectionable because I don't think a police officer or any sort of like a person in the criminal justice system is going to have like the biological knowledge to like justify like, no, I know the genealogy behind this person. This just attributing racial characteristics to an individual, treating that individual as representative of their broader group and making decisions based on top of it. I can't think of a more concrete example of something that is overtly racist than that. You're judging someone based on superficial characteristics. You do not know their genealogy. You're making very rough estimates that would not like be wouldn't be viable in any sort of like genealogical sense, and you're altering your behavior to affect their life based on that. That's just objectively, explicitly racist, and that's not how
well,
this
I
country
think that
like, ought
police
to go
often have information that makes it very clearly justifiable for them to be interested in someone's race. I mean, just the most obvious example of this is, for instance, the description of police suspects, right, which black people are highly disproportionately represented in.
Yeah, do you think that there might be some sort of like in-group preference to be able to differentiate between your own in-group and a little bit of like an out-group bias? You're not going to be able to differentiate between out-groups as much. Do you think that might be a case?
Sure.
All right. So do you think that maybe that's still kind of not fair that if you're born black, that you're going to be treated worse because you're born black just by default? Do you think that that's a good thing? Do you think that we ought to treat individuals based on like as representative of their general populations based on race?
So there are two things to say. So in the first place, we should say that, I should say that so far as we can tell, police sort of under pull over black people relative to their representation in those suspect descriptions. But in the second place, there are two different questions about, is it just for us to treat people a certain way? And is it fair from their perspective, right? Because if it is just objectively true that so far as I can tell, one person has a 10% chance of something being true of them and another 15% chance.
You think that's how we apply statistics? Do you think broad statistics representative of broad population groups, do you think that that applies to individuals? Like, so let's say that I, as a white person, I'm 15% of white people do X. Do you think that that means that I, as a white person, am 15% likely to do X? Do you think that's how like we should apply statistics?
If the only thing I know about you is that you're white, then that is what that would mean.
So once again, you're not denying systemic racism, or you're not even like denying that racism exists. You're trying to say that we ought to do it, that it's justified. I'm trying to think of like every single like racist outcome or racist policy or racist institution or racist like presidency in the United States. They were all justified based on some sort of rationality. I don't think that's good enough. I don't think that leads to favorable outcomes. I think that promotes more division in our society and perpetuates a lot of like worse outcomes for everyone involved. Like, for example, like if you otherize black people to the extent that we have in the United States, you're more likely to like oppose things like welfare and the social safety net, which hurts everybody. But people will justify it because it hurts the group that they think are less deserving of it. So we have this instance of like this justified racial animosity because black people don't deserve welfare as much as anyone else. You have that, like it hurts everybody. So I don't think how your like worldview here that we can predictively like judge someone's actions based on their race alone. I don't see how that like creates a better society for anyone involved.
So in the real world, right, we don't use race alone because we often have lots of different information about someone. But you were asking me about the predictive validity of race in itself. And there is predictive validity of race in itself. In the context of the criminal justice system, though, I don't think this amounts to something particularly radical to suggest that it's not a great crime if the reason why black people are overrepresented in bad outcomes of the criminal justice system is because, for instance, you know, they just have higher rates of criminality. Like I don't.
Yeah, I didn't argue that either. There's two questions. One, is that entirely explanatory? And the answer seems to be no. And two, what can we do to address that?
Well, I would say the answer to that is yes, that it does seem to be completely explanatory. So far as or at least we're not justified in saying it's not entirely explanatory.
No, it's not. It's not incredibly explanatory. That's much harder to prove. right? There do seem to be evidence of bias. Like, so for example, when a judge has discretion, they're more likely to be more harsh on Black individuals than white individuals. That seems to be it seems to be a reasonable inference, because no judge is going to say because they're Black, but it seems to be a reasonable inference that they are going to judge a Black suspect as more dangerous, more hostile than a white counterpart of the exact same like status. Now, obviously, that's very broad and it's not going to be the only factor involved, but if it is a factor involved, it seems to be that you would justify it because the judges would be rational in assuming that Black person would be more violent, which is just, that's justifying racist policies. Whereas I would say like that's something that ought not to be taken into consideration. Not only should it not be taken into consideration, but it's worth like checking to see if this bias exists within that individual judge, because that does not result in a fair judicial system.
Right. So when you talk about matching the defendants in these sorts of cases, what I would say is that most of the criminological literature doesn't sufficiently match them, and that the studies on sentencing that do sufficiently match them actually just show that there's not a racial difference in sentencing outcomes.
Okay, I'm going to say that they do. But they show that, like, with all else being equal, there is still, again, it's not like the only factor involved whatsoever, but there does seem, when you control for everything else, there does seem to be still a racial disparity there.
So I'll say, I guess, I'll get more specific in two ways. So weirdly, there's not a lot of meta-analytic evidence on this. The best meta-analysis on this that I have found is from like 1999, I think. It's by this guy Pratt. And that meta-analysis concluded that controlling for very obvious confounders reduced the difference in sentencing to non-significance. And then in the second place, if you look at the models that are being used and you filter out for the ones that are good in the sense of models that have explained the vast majority of the variance in sentencing outcomes to begin with the set of independent variables they're using in the model, that these almost all show that there's no racial difference in sentencing outcome, and that there's a huge number of statistically weak models in which racial bias persists, but I think that's best explained by the statistical weakness as models.
Okay, I'm not familiar with the exact statistical models that you're using or the exact studies that you're citing, so that's a weakness of a live debate, I suppose. But again, one of my primary arguments is that there doesn't need to be any bias whatsoever. Now, I think there's good justification for saying that there is bias, like individual bias, not because that police officers are in themselves like evil racists or the judges just hate Black people. I think it is a matter of pattern recognition, but that's a rationalization, but it's not a justification. We ought to treat individuals like individuals, and a judge does not sentence Black people. They sentence individuals on a case-by-case basis. And I don't think that assuming that a Black person is more likely to do X or Y or Z is a just outcome or a just way that we ought to conduce our judicial system. But again, none of that bias needs to exist for the systemic racism to be in place. I don't see how it's possible that seeing how we've had explicitly racist laws in this country that separated people out, that segregated the population into these concentrated areas of poverty, that those areas of poverty would affect not only one's economic opportunities, but their psyche. I don't see how that wouldn't play a significant factor in racial disparities that we still see today. We had an enormously racist history that was never meaningfully corrected, purposely keeping wealth out of the hands of people of color, and that was never corrected. The closest thing we came to correcting was in theory, we stopped enacting those racist actions, but that doesn't mean that those racist actions weren't still perpetuated. Just because a law says that you can't explicitly discriminate against Black people, well, those same biases that made that discrimination palpable to the public consciousness, those same biases within the public still existed, and they still can exist to this day. So there's a lot of ways that racism still perpetuates in the mind of other people, not because they're evil, but just because the linear force of culture, the cultural inertia. And I think that's I think that's way more explanatory than biology.
So it sounds like this just brings us back though to the intergenerational poverty thing, which we've already done. It ended in the same place of just their studies can't read studies live. So unless there's another avenue of that you want to explore that isn't just the direct effect of the poverty.
Well, it's not just poverty, although I do think I have better justification for bulimia, that especially like the stickiness at the ends. That is pretty relevant in literature. If you're born very poor, you're likely to stay very poor just because you have fewer opportunities. I don't see how that would be controversial at all. I mean, there's also the
well, I mean, you do know why I think that that's. I mean,
you think it's like biology and genes and stuff like that.
Right. Exactly. But anyway.
Okay. So, and I think that's kind of bunk. I don't think there's going to be I don't think there's like people.
Well, yeah, we don't agree with each other. So.
Yeah. Okay. I think I have better justification for my side, but of course that's why I believe what I do, and that's why you believe what you do. So, I also think that it's like being born into a lot of situations has affected the psyche. One theory of criminology would state that someone, especially a marginalized group who is like been kept out of society, are going to create a culture that is more likely to reject the rules of the dominant culture. So, if you are perpetually like discriminated against or kept out of avenues of society, you're more likely to reject the rules altogether. If you think that society, like let's say if you're black in the 1950s and 60s, let's say that you've been experienced like the enormous like levels of discrimination that black people were subject to, why the hell would you like treat society's laws as just if they have not been just to you, if the system has not been designed to benefit you but rather to explicitly exclude you? Wouldn't that make it more likely that you're more likely to engage in like risk-taking behaviors or behaviors that would be seen as criminal, but you might not accept the morality of like, why is smoking weed bad? Why do they say it's bad? I do not give a shit. These laws were not designed for a system that was ever meant to help me. So why would I accept some of these dumb rules that have been forced upon me? We see a lot of that in a lot of marginalized groups. A lot of marginalized groups, regardless of like genealogy, do see higher rates of crime just because if you have been marginalized by society, you are less likely. Now, obviously, this is a case-by-case basis. I'm not saying that every single marginalized person hates society, but it does explain at least a certain portion of the population are going to reject the rules of society simply because they perceive society as marginalizing them as a rule.
So I guess I would say three things. One, I think that'd be really hard to demonstrate causally that that's true. Two, I doubt that it's very reliably true just because you can easily think of marginalized minorities for them that it's not just like, say, Asians in the early 20th century, or for that matter, certain European immigrant groups that if you look at their serious violent crime rates, they weren't especially high. And then in the third place, I don't even think that black people are marginalized in contemporary American society. So maybe though they think it is. So I mean, I guess there's that. They think they are.
If they think they're marginalized, that would be my point, right? There's no way to objectively prove that a population is marginalized. It's all about perception. And also, like, go ahead.
And I do think that their perception of being marginalized has certain psychological effects on them, but I don't think it explains their higher crime rates particularly.
Okay, do you think their higher crime rates come down to biology and like the, right?
There's not a whole lot of direct research on the biological causes of crime in general, but B, specifically with respect to racial differences. There's some suggestive data that biology plays a role, but I would more just say that it's plausible that biology is a significant effect, and that the kinds of environmental variables that people normally point to, things like poverty, lead exposure, single parent family, stuff like this, these are absolutely not significant contributors.
Single parent families aren't like a contributing factor?
Like not one, a significant one of the racial gap.
Now, I'm not going to, okay. So, well, one, lead absolutely does have an effect, but I kind of get what you mean. Like not a significant portion of the population was exposed to lead. Not that you're not saying that like lead exposure is a null thing, right? Just that not enough people have been exposed to lead poisoning to make it a significant factor, right?
Oh, no, I actually think that the lead thing is a null.
A null.
I mean, it's also true.
Okay, whatever.
Well, there are two different things that are both true. A, lead exposure rates are low and the differences between races are small enough such that even if there is an effect of lead on crime, it's not going to explain much of the crime rate difference. And B, though, I also think it is true that lead impacting crime is probably not a correct theory to begin with.
It's probably, well, no one's going to say that it's like the explanatory factor. It's just one.
Well, of course not. But I'm talking about, does it have any causal
effect? I want to go back to like the single parent households. You don't think that that would like, you don't think that that has an effect on people?
In terms of criminality, I don't, it probably doesn't. And if it does, it's not very big.
Okay, but that's true for like white and black families. Like, if you're born to a single parent household, you're more likely to engage in criminal activity for a variety of reasons. One, just there's correlates. Like, single parent households probably have lower amounts of wealth just because now there's definitely only one source of income. It's going to be harder for that. It's going to be harder for that parent to make enough income to support you and also spend enough time with you to like develop this proper like parent bond to set boundaries and morals and stuff like that. And because a lot of like social safety nets have been gutted or they're inadequate in the country, it's going to result in a lot more like freedom in a bad way for kids to like go out and engage in activities that may lead them to more criminal like ideation in the future. I don't think that's a very viable like argument to have, that single, like being born to a single parent household has a negligible effect on criminality. I think that's a pretty big one.
Sure. So, I mean, there are a few things. So definitely kids that come from single parent homes have a somewhat elevated risk of criminality. But again, the question is, causally speaking, why? There's research that has found that, for instance, coming from a broken home doesn't predict criminality once you control for the father's rate of criminality, the left, which suggests to me that the effect is not directly causal. And there's also research
showing that... Wait, do you think those are separate? Like, a father's rate of criminality can directly explain why the family is in a broken home, right? So you're like, you're taking away... Yeah, and you're like controlling led to the same factor, right? You're like comparing like broken families in which like the father left for like good reasons and versus like broken families where the father left for bad reasons. Like, that's a research, weird distinction to make.
So the point would be that the father isn't there, but that it is his criminality, which seems to be the predictive factor in his child's criminality, which is consistent, obviously, with an indirect genetic causation. There's also data, though, I should say, showing that children, when their parents are arrested and taken away and incarcerated, when that initially happens, there's a disruption to their behavior, but that their behavior in the long run actually improves because the parents who tend to be removed in that sort of way, which is a significant factor in explaining the single parent rate among African Americans and how it's risen since the 60s, that those parents tend to be not very good parents to begin with. And too often, I think when we talk about the effect of single parent homes, we're assuming that if the parents were there, they would be decent parents. Which is not true.
Well, of course, like it's not a one-to-one assumption. Like, you can't make that assumption with every single case. But I think broadly speaking, it's better for the parents to be there than not. And one of the giant like reasons we had this giant spike in arrests of black people specifically was like the war on drugs. Like it was an enormous increase, I believe, in the 80s, like of these giant this giant spike in arrests of way disproportionately like people of color. And, like, they were for like drug crimes like. Have been a horrible like idea in terms of like arresting people for drug offenses have like really, really disrupted families. They perpetuated cycles of both poverty and criminality. And there doesn't seem to be any like reason for them to be like the net benefit for society seems to be like very negative for a lot of these arrest records. However, one of the reasons that they gained such popularity is because they were seen to primarily target people of color. If you look at like a lot of like policing decisions and criminal justice decisions that have gained popular support in this country, if they are perceived to hurt people of color more, they have more popular support from a largely white electorate. And so I think that it's not unreasonable to assume that because of that like otherization that white people have imposed upon people of color, we support policies that hurt them more to keep them down, to keep them from approaching these levels of like whatever measure you want to use to keep them from like white measures of success. And that seems to be like something that has perpetuated itself via policy and the result of policies which inform for further policies. That's what I mean by systemic racism. It's never just a group of police officers being implicitly racist. It's always like policies that inform results, that inform policies to the point where like people today might be like post hoc racist. They might not hold any of that Jim Crow era racism, but they see the vast discrepancies. They believe in the false notion that we live in a race blind society that is, you know, just to everyone within it. And so they work backwards from that to say that, well, since Black people and Hispanic people, which is weird to put Hispanic people into a single race, we see that discrepancy and think, oh, well, there just must be something wrong with them. And that doesn't seem to be a very like good way to approach things if we want society to be better.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we've a few things. One, the disproportionate level of incarceration among African Americans is mostly not due to drug laws. I don't support drug laws, but whatever. So I don't think it's that explanatory anyway. Generally speaking, a lot of the laws that most disproportionately affect African-Americans are not things that we put in place to harm them. The things like laws against murder, things like this.
Well, of course not.
A lot of the things that today are talked about sometimes as prime examples of things that are laws that we put in place with malice against Black people at the time, it was literally the opposite was true. So just to pick two examples. So for instance, when and these don't exist anymore, but they existed for decades and leftists talked a lot about them. The federal minimum mandatory guideline, sentencing guidelines, having to do with the fact that crack was punished a lot more heavily than cocaine. And starting like the late 90s, leftists started to complain about this as something that racists had done. But back in the 80s, as a matter of fact, this was something very strongly supported by sort of quote unquote African-American leaders and such of the time and in Congress, because of the fact that they thought that, you know, the crack was destroying their communities in various ways. The same thing is true of that crime bill in the early 90s and the Black Caucus or whatever.
Well, of course, like it would be like no one would argue that like Black people aren't subject to the same like societal biases as everyone else, right?
Like, well, you had said that these laws were supported by white people.
Yeah, largely white people, but also Black people as well. Disproportionately white people in some cases. But the laws that I was talking about, I wasn't talking about like specific like the crack versus cocaine laws. I was talking about like welfare policies. Like welfare policies were broadly supported by white people until people of color were brought to the table. And because of that perception that it was going to go to someone who was less deserving, then they stopped supporting those policies. And because of that, a lot of Black people did not get the same leg up as white people. And so a lot of people now live in areas of concentrated poverty, which is way more conducive to crime. If you are I can't. So can I just get a solid answer on this? If you are born to an area of concentrated urban poverty with a high crime rate, do you think that you have the same likelihood of criminality as someone born out in like a suburban area of relative wealth?
If all else is equal,
we have two.
Then yeah, roughly.
Wait, you have the same likelihood?
Yeah, roughly.
We have two twins. One's born into areas of concentrated urban poverty with high crime rate, and one's born into relative wealth. You think they have the relative same level of likelihood of engaging in criminality?
Yeah. So okay. In general,
I don't know what to say to that.
Well, in general, of course, it is true that people born in those contexts do have higher crime rates. There are
like biology.
They're what are called sibling analysis studies, where what they do is they follow families over time that change out of those situations and see if these siblings born during those situations have higher crime rates than those born once they escape those situations. And what they find is that after accounting for what the researchers call these unobserved family factors, that there is no causal effect of neighborhood disadvantage on criminality. And this is not something I just made up. It's just what researchers found.
I know, but it's almost like self-selecting additive, like families who make it out of those situations. Yeah, obviously they're going to be one of the lucky ones who make it out. So it's like survivorship bias. You're only looking at people who have made it out of like bad situations and like comparing them.
Well, no, it also looks at people who they get worse. The point is to look at variation in neighborhood disadvantage over time in families.
Okay, I just think it's a ridiculous concept. Like if you have more opportunities to commit crime with all else being equal, you're just as likely to commit crime as someone who is like not.
We should be fairly distrustful, I think, even of the social science itself, given things like the replication crisis that have occurred. We should not be basing our political views on intuitively plausible narratives, I don't think, that aren't heavily supported by causal data.
Okay, but I kind of agree with you. There is a replication crisis, especially in the social sciences. I think the answer to that is more funding. Like it's hard to fund studies that just do the same thing again. I'll agree with you that that's an enormous problem in academia. But I also think that some intuition can be a good like avenue towards looking at different things. And it seems to be like I would have to like do.
I think that's a very dangerous way to end up being used by systems, right? Because our intuitions are so shaped by what authorities tell us, and you're born into a society, they shape your intuitions in various ways. And if you end up basing your empirical worldview on those intuitions, they can.
You know what? I'll take the L on that. One of my arguments is that a lot of people intuit that we are in a post-racial society, that no one's racist anymore, and therefore, like any discrepancies must be the result of something other than systemic or historic or implicit racism. And so, yeah, I'll take the L on that specific point that, yeah, intuition ought not to be the only thing that like influences policy decisions. But I think there's enough research, especially when it comes to like systemic racism, when it comes to like the disparities not being solely the result of behavior alone. I think there's enough to say that at least there's something that is influencing like the bias of like the people at all levels of the criminal justice system. But again, that bias is not the determining factor of whether or not a system is systemically racist. It is the historical factors of racism, of explicitly racist laws that inform like where people are now. I think it's a ridiculous assertion to say that like two people of like the equivalent genetics, like one born into a wealthy family in the suburbs, one born into like concentrated poverty in a high crime rate area. I think it's very, very unlikely that those two people will have the same propensity for crime. Genealogy can't account for all of that. People are incredibly adaptable. In fact, the strongest biological fact of humanity is that we are adaptable. We adapt to our environments. And so like we are going to make decisions both short-term and long-term based on the environment around us. That is going to be way more explanatory of actions. If you put a gene into two different environments, it is going to express itself much differently because genes are inert molecules. They are only reactive. They must have an environment in order to perpetuate any sort of action. So no, I think I know that intuition is not the best way to go forwards on these things, but that seems so wrong on its face that I would need to see an incredible amount of like empirical data supporting that. That people born into like areas of concentrated poverty have the same level of criminality when you control for like every other single factor.
Sure. Although obviously, I mean, I could link you something, but it'd be like a live. I mean, we can talk. I didn't really plan on talking about this, but we could talk directly, I guess, about sort of the intersection between genetics, race, and crime, since we seem to be.
Did not prepare. Did not do most of my research regarding like genetics and crime.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, I haven't. I've tried to not directly talk about. Just you seem to keep referencing.
It seems to not be very explanatory for differences. My main argument regarding my primary argument, and I know this is true, is that you would not, if you went from the bottom up, if you had no knowledge of white, black, Asian, what have you, you would not get the same racial categorizations that we use today from solely genetic data. I know for a fact that people started with white, black, or red, or what have you, and then they worked backwards to justify why people ought to be grouped into those different racial categorizations. I know that to be true. And so then that's
his name is Bernier, this explorer who I want to say it's in the 16th century who we got the first sort of global modern racial taxonomy from. As far as I recall, for him it was just, I mean, he was one of the first people to have traveled around all the, you know, major continents of the time, and then he just thought that, it was based on continental ancestry, and just these people from these different places tend to look different. I don't think it's that. Or you can look at early sort of more scientific theories, like a Blumenbach or something like this. And there's no, I don't know. It seems fairly consistent with the modern view.
Do you think that it would be useful and explanatory to use those concepts of race that we have today, which would be black and white and Hispanic and Asian? Do you think that those are useful categorizations that can reliably predict criminality or reliably predict anything? They're so broad.
I mean, like, for instance, the percentage of black in an area is more predictive of its crime rate than is things like its unemployment rate, its poverty rate, its single motherhood rate, etc.
Okay, why do you think that is? You're going to say it's biology, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know why I think that.
I know why it's predictive, but also like all those things correlate.
But you asked me factors? If you could use that to predict. I mean, I would just answer your question. Could you use that to predict criminality? And the answer to that is yes.
Do you think you can use it to predict the criminality of an individual person? As in, would you think that it is justified for a police officer or any other member of the criminal justice system to use race as a predictive factor in an individual, whether or not they should be like get a certain crime sentence or whether they should be perceived as dangerous?
Well, like I said before, in the case of sentencing, I don't think that's happening, but it is just objectively true
that
at the individual level, there is predictive validity of race. Now, obviously, it's not entirely predictive.
So, for instance, it might decrease
your rate of error by 20%.
You're literally saying that you ought, but you're not. So you've kind of conceded the point that we ought to be racist, that should be something that we do. We should introduce
more racial bias. If by racism you mean using race as a heuristic when race objectively predicts a criterion of interest, which is different than just hating someone due to their race.
Well, hold on. No, that's still racism. It by any other name.
Well, you can call
name.
It racism. I mean, I'm fine with that. I just want to also be clear about what we're talking about.
Yeah, but also you're saying that you can use it to predict an individual's behavior, which is what a member of the criminal justice system does when they are interacting with somebody. And that is, I think that's ridiculous. No, obviously you can't use that. Like that would be
if race is predictive,
that would be antithetical to like every single American value that we have. In fact, a lot of people like that perpetuate racist systems have to pretend that they don't exist in order to like still be proud as an American. They have to pretend that those racial disparities don't exist. You're kind of like endorsing this notion that we should treat people different.
No, I mean, if I'm predicting what you're going to act like 10 minutes from now, I'm going to use a bunch of things, all of which are imperfect predictors. At this point, the best of which is your past behavior, maybe your reputation of people like you online, because I actually didn't know particularly much about you specifically. In another situation, it might be something about how you look. This is just how prediction works. It's based on variables, all of which are imperfect predictors.
All of which are incredibly imperfect and subject to like generational biases, right? Like our notion of like what white people are like and what black people are like did not come spring forth out of the void with each individual, right? We're influenced by those societal
aspects. Part of the reason why I keep having the caveat, as long as it's objectively true that it is linked to the criterion of interest. If it's an incorrect stereotype, then of course that should not be used. That's not rationally justifiable.
A stereotype, there's usually some sort of like broad societal like statistic that would like justify a racial stereotype. They don't spring forth out of nowhere. But the point of like why we ought not to use stereotypes is because they're very, very low predictive capabilities for an individual person. That's the entire point of rejecting stereotypes.
So and what you're saying is to use a predictor that, for instance, explains 10% of the variance in something is to use it as if it explains 10% of the variance, not zero and not 100. I mean, this is an objectively rational. It's not an opinion. It's just an objectively rational way to treat such a predictor. And it's not as if it has no predictive validity at all.
Interesting. And I'll give you a chance to respond, Justin. But I do, after that, want to kind of return more to the topic that we talked about earlier.
Okay. So do you think that we ought... So
a question will probably just carry it on. I hate to interrupt.
A question, God. Okay, cool. I'll just say that no, I think this notion that we should use race as a factor in sentencing is ridiculous on its face. It's not going to happen. Both of us know it's not going to happen. Everyone in the audience knows it's not going to happen unless we take a very dark turn in society. I think that so there are a lot of like policies that we can use to reduce racial disparities and like pretending that there's a biological component to race that would justify why criminals are the way that they are based on race. One, there's no like race is not a socially constructed thing.
Might be a good chance, pretty quick here.
All right, I'll let him respond to that. I was going to drone on some more.
I would just reemphasize that we're talking right now about a theoretical justification, but in the case of sentencing, I just think it's factually true that people that act the same way, like the race is not used in this way. So,
but you think it ought to be used?
There are situations where it could be justified, yeah. But but in terms of what's actually happening, it's not.
Well, it is being used.
Well, anyway, let's be.
So
if we actually return.
Yeah.
Any particular issues you guys want to bring up before we go into Q&A shortly?
I'm good to Q&A unless he wants to address something.
I guess we could move to the Q&A.
You got it. And our guests are linked in the description, folks. Want to let you know that as we jump into the Q&A, Coding Jesus says, Jangles, if we pay people to not commit crime through welfare or resource allocation, are we not being extorted by a group of criminals?
No, I think that if you want to reduce crime in the United States, you ought to enact policies that have been proven to reduce it without destroying the very communities that are the victims of it. So it's not just that people of color commit more crime, they're also the victims of more crime. So enacting policies that are just like broken windows policing and stop and frisk, once stop and frisk doesn't meaningfully reduce crime in any significant capacity, especially when you compare it to like the vast level of like racial and animosity that it creates. Broken windows policing is another example that it reduces crime a little bit, but it also produces way harsher outcomes for the people that live in that community than we get benefits from reducing that crime rate. So no, I don't think, I think that like enacting policies that give people more opportunities to pursue other options, like to give them more opportunities to have that social and economic mobility. No, you're not being extorted by people who commit more crime. You're trying to actually address the root cause of it. It's like saying like your drug addicts are extorting you for rehab.
You got it. This one coming in from, do appreciate your question. Tristan Jones says, Jangles, do poor people commit more crime because they are poor, or are they poor because they choose crime over productive endeavors?
Well, it's hard, for a causal factor, you're probably going to be poor before you commit crime, although they can certainly perpetuate themselves. So being poor is not the same across the country. There's a difference between urban poverty and rural poverty. If for the sole reason that rural poverty, like where are you going to commit your crimes? Right? The nearest person is 20 miles away. So there are, it's hard to be causal, but being born poor is more causal in predicting criminality than the other way around. Although certainly if you are a criminal, if you're a criminal and you have a criminal offense on your record, you're fucked. We basically guarantee that you are not going to, you're going to have a far less likelihood of getting a viable job. And you're more likely to be to just get right back into the system, because what are your other options? So I think those are worth addressing in criminal justice reform, like trying to make it so that like felons and other like criminals have more opportunities to pursue a life outside of crime.
You got it. And Coding Jesus also says, Jangles, why do you hide behind single parents while supporting policies that encourage fatherless homes, like when the state replaces father via welfare?
I don't hide behind that at all. One, I think that two parents in the home are generally pretty good. Now, we can't automatically assume that like a single parent, like an unmarried parent, has only one parent in the household. There is a little bit of a discrepancy there. Like you can't have two parents in a household without both of them being married. But also I feel like welfare does improve people's lives. You can't afford basic necessities, which reduces stress, which also makes it so that you have more opportunities to pursue other like pursuits, to be redundant. It costs a lot of money to be poor, and so welfare policies that can help lift people out of that poverty, it's not just you're giving them the opportunity to lift themselves further out of poverty. If you have no money, you don't have opportunities to get money. So no, I don't think this promotes fatherlessness. It promotes mobility.
You got it, and thanks very much for your question. Mark Reed says, Sean, do you have any data to support a causal link between race and criminality, or do you only have correlation and are therefore making baseless claims?
Sure. So it's like I kind of talked about before. If you're asking about a genetic link, that the research on the genetic, while through twin studies, we know that genetics explains a significant amount of the variation in criminality, the research specifically on the link between genetics, crime, and race is somewhat weak. What we know for sure is that a lot of the environmental variables that are often cited do not explain much of the variance, and that there's no reason. And in fact, since individual variation within populations is significantly due to genes, we should assume that that would naturally be also true across groups. I mean, there is some direct research, though, that we could talk about. So the thing most oftenly talked about, for instance, is that there's a gene, the MAOA gene, the monoamine oxidase A gene, which breaks down a certain class of neurotransmitters in the brain. If you have a low repeat version of it, it tends to make you seemingly more impulsive, more violent. This has been written about for decades in the criminological literature. Those low repeat variants are much more common among African Americans than white Americans, but that's just one example. But again, I don't want to place too much emphasis on this because I don't think we have a super good understanding on the exact genetic architecture of criminality to begin with.
You got it. And Cillian Holland says, poverty is genetic now. What kind of eugenic nonsense is this?
Oh, that's the consensus in behavioral genetics. I mean, I'm sorry if no one told you, but
I don't believe that for a second. Sorry, I'm not going to take your word for that. There's a poverty gene.
Yeah, so two things. Firstly, I would say that there have been dozens of studies showing the heritability in traits like this. And the second place, in fact, I mean, it's literally called the first law of behavioral genetics, that any trait which significantly varies within a population is going to be significantly heritable. And that's what I was thinking of when I called it just the consensus in behavioral genetics. That law was penned by Eric Turkheimer, who's a very left-wing behavioral geneticist of that. But yeah.
This one coming in from, do appreciate your question, Ryan B says, Sean, thoughts on the quote unquote ghost ancestors study showing African American people having up to 19% of DNA throughout ancient history. Let's see. It's hard to make sense of that one, Ryan B. That one's a little bit confusing for me. But do have another one, this one coming in from Forward Tribe says, if the system is composed by individuals of every race, then how can the system be racist, Jangles?
Because it doesn't require any implicit bias whatsoever on the part of the individual actors. People are assumed that, like, if a black person born into a racist system cannot be biased against black people, when that's absolutely not the case. All right. I'm sure Sean would agree that plenty of white people are biased against white people. So it's not like
so true.
I know it's yeah. So it's not so. Therefore, it'd be a pretty weak argument to say that black people can't also justify discrimination based on, you know, based on race. In fact, there's a lot of evidence to say, like, system justification theory has routinely pointed out that there are certain members of every single group that will justify discrimination against them because there's a palliative effect. It makes them feel better if they think that they have a better, a shot at society because there is no bias. It makes them kind of feel better. And so to do that, they'll ignore discrimination when it happens. It happens to LGBT people. It happens to black people. It happens to, like, almost any group of people that you could think of that's been studied. If they are a marginalized group, they will ignore situations of discrimination when it's very obviously happening because it makes them feel better about, like, being themselves.
Gotcha.
Well, are we? I don't know if we're supposed to.
You can, if
can
you'd
I
like,
comment on the
especially
question?
Especially because we've run out of questions. So go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say that in psychology, there's a kind of standardized way of measuring behavioral discrimination, which is separate from implicit discrimination. Which has to do with you bring people in a room, you describe for them a situation, and you find out how they would treat a person in a given situation. You do that with one sample, the person's white. You do that with another sample, the person is black. They're otherwise, you know, the exact same at a level that you could never get in any real world scenario. And there have been meta-analyses of this sort of discrimination literature. And what it shows is that on average, white Americans don't have a net bias. On average, African Americans do have a significant in-group bias. You can see the same thing if you just ask people to rate, like, how warmly they feel about different racial groups, including their own and such. And the group that stands out is white liberals having a bias against their own group. So that, well, it's certainly true that there are black individuals that are going to have a bias against their own group. This is much more typical of the white population than any other population. And our default assumption looking at any group of black people should always be that this is not true until we have quite strong evidence showing that it is in their case.
So regarding that first point, no, I have, like, there's significant evidence pointing to the exact opposite scenario. So, like, there's one study done on police officers where even though they were less likely to use, like, lethal force against, like, training scenarios when the suspect was black than the general population, they were still quicker to identify armed black suspects than they were armed white suspects. And they were quicker to, like, turn away from armed, from unarmed white suspects than they were unarmed black suspects. That might, now, when we talk about, like, broad trends, that might not mean anything. That might not have the statistical power to, like, meaningfully translate into real world actions, but cops will tell you that in those split second decisions, it might factor into it. We also have experimental studies showing that, like, the darker a subject's skin is in either the description or, like, in, like, a digitally, like, darkened image, juries, like, so mock juries are more likely to treat the darker suspect with less less favorability, with less generosity than a lighter skinned counterpart, showing that, like, with everything else being equal, because this is an experiment, this is one of the few places we can, like, definitely parse out one variable, the population as a whole is more likely to be to treat darker skinned applicants worse because they're going to associate more negative traits with them.
So there have been because this research has been going on for decades, there's been a ton of studies showing all sorts of things. So what I would point to importantly is firstly, what I was referencing before, I believe the author Ziegler's meta-analysis of this stuff in general, which meta-analysis, you know, always takes precedent over any kind of single study. In the case of mock jurors, there have also been meta-analyses, and they find a very slight bias in the case of white mock jurors that is not practically significant, and in the case of African Americans, a very large bias, which is very practically significant. And I think these meta-analytic results are to be preferred over single studies from social psychology, which tends to be fairly unreliable to begin with as a discipline.
So a big problem is that, like, there's all these, like, small variables that add up. Like, no, like, there's the like, so there are, so I'm looking at a mock jury meta-analysis right here. Let's see. It is the Mitchell, Hall, Pfeiffer. I don't know if that means anything to you, but this was completed in 2005. And they said that there was a small but still significant impact on like racial bias in their jury selection. That doesn't have to be the only explanatory factor that would point to systemic racism, but all these small things that never explain like the majority of the discrepancy, all of these small things still add up to something that is like, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. And I don't think that like as an American, we should like tolerate any sort of like racial disparity that is the result of racial bias in our systems. That includes like even post hoc justifications for like, well, Black people commit more crime, therefore we should judge Black people as more likely to commit crime. I don't think that like flies with like our American ethos or the policy decisions that we should make going forward.
So, I mean, there are two things I would say. Firstly, I think this just is the measure of bias. And so there aren't a whole other bunch of other things we can add. I'm not sure. I can try to communicate this to the audience that is not particularly used to statistics. In that Mitchell et al. Meta-analysis, the mean effect size for African-Americans was 0.43, which is by any standard quite practically significant. For white Americans, it was 0.028 in terms of verdict decisions. That you could never, that is something that you could never discern by the naked eye. It explains far less than 1% of the variance in the outcome. Same thing is true for looking at an even bigger difference in terms of the bias in sentence length, where the African-American effect size is 0.73. In the case of white Americans, still not even 0.1. This is the effect found in that meta-analysis is so small. You could add it 10 times and you still would hardly have anything.
This question coming in, this one's for you, Sean. Click. Oh, okay, so they say, well, they lost it. One. Oh, they say, Sean is the kind of guy that says, quote, I'm not racist because even though you're inferior to me and I don't want you to be around me, I don't hate you. Is this true, Sean? Is there any way in which you would say that your position is in jeopardy of what they're accusing you of?
Sure. I mean, especially if the I don't want to be around you thing. I don't know what they're getting at there. I'm not a white nationalist. I'm fine with non-white people being in the country and then the community that I live in and that sort of thing. Whether or not someone's inferior. I mean, most people are not criminals. We're just talking about criminality here. And if someone is a criminal, that doesn't singularly make them inferior or superior to another person. There are people who I think are worse than me and better than me of every race. Now, I'm not going to try to dishonestly dodge this and say that I think that that's equally frequent in every race. I don't think it is, but it's not a monolithic thing. And there are great Black people and bad Black people, great white people and bad white people. It just differs in the proportions. If you want to think that makes me a racist, then fine, but it's not racist in a way that I find morally problematic. And there is a version of racism I find morally problematic, which is irrationally hating someone on the basis of their ancestry.
You got it. This one coming in from Troll Nerd says, Sean, you keep saying, quote, the data shows dot, 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 but we have no way to verify your claim. Why should anyone take your word for it?
I'll actually defend that a little bit. No one is going to be able to bring up every single study or data point that they have during a live discussion. So even if you're using it to attack Sean, like that would equally apply to me. So unless you specifically state like the authors of a study and even better, like the title of the study, or if we have like our like sources like listed out beforehand, that's just not a fair accusation to level at either of us. So, hey, look at that. All right.
That's only true. I would also say that, anyone who wants can go to my blog, ideasanddata.wordpress.com. I have been writing about this sort of stuff for many years. There's most of the citations I've named are in my writing there that you can go read for yourself. I'm currently working on revising some of the crime stuff, so a few of the things I've cited here won't be there, but they will be soon. If you really want to check my sources, you can go there, and it'll either already be there or will be there soon.
You got it. Want to say thanks, everybody. Do appreciate all of your questions, and want to let you know we are thrilled to have many more juicy debates like this one. Let me know if you happen to have any other questions, and otherwise we're going to wrap up. Our guests are linked in the description, but want to say thanks so much, Sean and Jangles. And by the way, folks, our guests are also linked in the description at the podcast, as we do have a podcast as well, and so do want to encourage you to check that out. And so thank you very much, gentlemen, Sean and Justin. It has been a great time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me as well. And thanks for being willing to do the debate. Obviously, a lot of people aren't, so I appreciate that also.
100%. Well, thank you guys. And with that, we will be back in just a moment. Namely, Andy and myself, my co-moderator there that you see in the bottom right screen there, will be back in just a moment letting you know about upcoming debates that we're excited about. So stick around. We'll be back in just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, just loading up the screen as we are excited to share with you folks. I am going to also introduce my dearest friend, Andrew, who we're excited to have here. It's going to be a good time as we are going to share with you just some of the upcoming stuff for Modern Day Debate. But I also want to introduce you to Andrew and want to say thanks, Andrew, for co-moderating. But I do want to say thanks, folks, for being with us. Do want to say hello to you there in the chat, as you really do appreciate you being with us. And so, one sec. Extra frosting pancake. I saw you were disappointed, and I am very sorry for not saying hello to you in the live chat. And so I am sincerely sorry for that. It was nothing personal. It's oftentimes that in the live chat, as a general rule, I'm greeting new people. And so I understand where you're coming from, and that's why I do apologize, as I agree. I should have said hi to you, and I'm sorry about that. And so I do hope you have a great rest of your night, regardless of what your decision is. But want to say, we are thrilled to have you here, folks. Sergio Miguel, I see there in the old live chat, as well as Brian, let me know if it's pronounced Nagayan, Nugian, let me know. But John Edwards, glad you were with us, as well as Bubblegum Gun and Retink. Thanks for being with us. Glad you are with us, as well as 54321 Truth. And thanks for becoming a member or renewing your membership. Surgeon General says, hope everyone had a great weekend. Thanks for coming. Appreciate that. Thanks so much, Surgeon General. Seriously, that really does mean a lot. And Grigory Asayan, thanks for being with us, as well as Chuck Pike and Contrary Marge. Thanks for being with us, as well as Furry S and Dright Life. And Avoid. Good to see you, John Edwards. Glad you are with us. And Sadie, good to see you. Thanks for coming by. Hope you're doing well, as well as Zed Dez and L Jim. But do want to introduce you, my dear friends. Andy is the name of my co-moderator for tonight. And Andy, you guys don't know, but Andy's actually been a part of the Modern Day Debate community. He's watched many debates, but he's never spoken up in the chat. And also, though, on an even deeper level, Andy's actually been involved in Modern Day Debate via being a tech guy in terms of helping me learn some of the tech stuff, but also in terms of some of the epic topics that we've hosted. Andy's been a person that I've been bouncing ideas with. And like I said, he's been in the live chat with you many a times while you've been watching live. He's been there watching live with you, but he's just an introverted fellow. And so he's oftentimes not saying hello. But Andy, want to give you a chance to say hello. Thanks so much for your being with us and supporting Modern Day Debate as you have.
Hello. Oh, hello. Hi. It's great to meet everyone. Yeah. Pretty introverted and just behind the scenes helping James out with some stuff. And I think this month in particular, James is real busy with school. So that's why I'm here doing some extra work here to help him out a little bit during these times where he's very busy.
It has been busy.
Glad to meet everyone.
Thank you, Andy. And I totally appreciate Andy and Bob and Brooke and just so many people that have been so helpful with the channel in terms of supporting it, especially while I've been basically getting ground into the ground. It's been a just crazy month, folks. I do want to say that we appreciate you being patient, as we haven't had as many debates as we usually do. We know it's down to like two or three a week. Some weeks it's only one. And so we are just in a temporary tight spot where my time is super restricted, as I have my comprehensive exam in less than a month. So it's going to be over soon. That's good. And so I am excited about that, but want to say hello to more of you in chat. Tony Swan, thanks for being with us, as well as Freaky Friday and Brandocious. Thanks for coming by. Good to see you. La Tornado says, beta. And Mark Reed, good to see you Ariel Suarez, glad you're here. Hierophant, thanks for coming by, as well as Rum Runner, good to see you again. And Sideshow Nav, thanks for coming by. Pumped that you are with us. And then Frank says, I didn't get groated. You mean greeted? We are pumped to have you here, Frank. And so we, as I mentioned in the live chat, you guys, I don't even know. I always wonder too. Hey, what, I don't know what you think, Andy. Like, I'm like, do people, I hope they don't think it's weird that I'm saying hi. I used to even like search out, like I would type in, you know, cause you can do in the live chat, you can put like, you know, at, you know, put the at symbol. And then you just type two letters and you'll see like whoever's there who has that, those first two letters in their name. And I used to like do that to like see who's in chat, who hasn't spoken up to greet them too. But then I actually heard from someone, they're like, no, no, that's creepy. Don't do that. So I don't do it anymore. Now I only greet people that are like in the chat, that are speaking in the chat. But anyway, Andy, is this creepy? Was it creepy that I did that?
It wasn't. I honestly didn't know you could see people who weren't talking.
Oh yeah. I mean, let me.
Oh, just participants. If you just go to manage participants or something.
I don't think it. No. It works if you're watching via desktop. You can type in like at, and then, you know, I could put like, let me see if I can find somebody that if I put.
Oh, stuff will just come up.
Yeah. Okay, so I see. Yeah, I just put like RE and then Rembrandt pops up. And I already knew Rembrandt was there, but it'll pop up even if a person hasn't spoken up in chat.
You can actually
search, but it doesn't work via phone. But long story short, I do want to say, folks, we always try to greet new people just to especially make them feel welcome if they're new. And so, but I do also want to greet people who have been here for a long time as well, members and moderators. And so if I've ever not greeted you, I apologize for that. It's just that we're, like I said, oftentimes we're excited to have new people here. And so Big Sky 789, thanks for coming by. Good to see you. Essay the Dolphin, am I saying it right? Let me know. Oliver Catwell, good to see you. Says, hi, James. More good vibes. Thanks, Oliver Catwell. Seriously, that means a lot. And then John Edwards says, we are Modern Day Debates. There's no doubt about that, John Edwards. You guys make this channel epic, and I'm very serious. I'm not kidding you. This channel really, like, it is a truly community kind of, like, own channel in the sense that you guys, I'm just thankful that oftentimes people come to us and they're like, hey, we already found, you know, I already found an opponent to debate. Do you want to host us? And they're like, sure. Like, thanks for doing that. Like, that's awesome. That they've already set it up. That's one example. But even if you hit like on this video right now, that helps the channel. If you share a video, for example, that helps the channel. And we really do appreciate the mods, for example, who've done a great job. And where, hey, I know a lot of people are like, oh, screw YouTube's terms of service. And I sympathize. There's a part of me that is, you could say, anti-authority, you know, in the sense that, it, you know, just like, I think there's an anti-authority part to all of us to a degree. It comes in different degrees, but the point is this. We still abide by YouTube's terms of service because YouTube's helped us grow a lot. I mean, one of our videos has had 4 million impressions. Just one video has had 4 million times where YouTube has put it in somebody's recommended video list. I mean, YouTube has helped us grow immensely, and so that's why we're like, hey, we're going to follow the terms of service. And we are excited about the future, though. We do want to let you know, we do have some debates that are exclusively on podcast, especially if they seem to perhaps violate terms of service. That's something that we usually do. And then Chuck Pike, good to see you there in the old chat, as well as Sean Z Bonanzi, thanks for coming by, as well as Ego Brain and Plummy 005, glad you made it, says Modern Day Debates, great moderating to both as always. Suggestion, you think it would be better for both debaters to share their studies with each other before the debate? Might make it smoother. I'm totally open to that. I appreciate you saying that. And I actually think that's a good idea, especially for the more technical debaters. That's a great idea. And so I appreciate you saying that. And then Frank says, I've got my shirt off. Thanks, Frank. There's nothing more charming than that. But Iron Horse, let's see, says, you asked me to debate about gravity. You owe me, man. Yes, it is true that after you mentioned you'd be interested in that topic, I did reach out to you in the, what's the word I'm looking for? I did eventually reach out to you via email to see if you wanted to debate Jockle on that. I hope you've talked to Amy, by the way, just as a side note. Jason Miller, good to see you, says, comply like a sheep. Thank you for that support, Jason. And then this one coming in from 1888, I'm telling, let's see, says, how, H-O-M-O-S-E-X-U-E-A-L, is it that doesn't work on the phone, James? Is it that doesn't work on the phone, James? I don't get. Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying like, so we do want to, as that's why you got timed out. We do have to follow the YouTube terms of service, is that you've learned it firsthand. And let's see. Iron Horse jumping on the old monkey pile. Iron Horse, I really do hope that you do reach out to Amy and make amends. And then let's see. Brian Najuyan says, I think modern debate is a.
I think it's win, isn't it? Maybe.
Huh?
Win, I think.
For who?
Oh, sorry. I thought you were asking about that name. Never mind.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, sorry. Brian Wynn.
Like Scotty Wynn.
Oh, okay. Thank
the
you.
The poker player.
And but yes, you want to say thank you so much. Two hats for being with us. Thanks, Andy, for letting me know what that means. Andy keeps me up to date on the cool terms, my dear friends. But yeah, for real, I do want to introduce you to Andy because he will be on more often. He's been helping. He's been trying to really jump in and like take because he's got a good amount of experience with YouTube. Frankly, I think more than me. But Andy is helping out as I am, especially as I'm trying to catch up on life with this comps exam. And so I can assure you, though, not only has Andy been a part of the community and oftentimes in the live chat with you and in the introverted fellow. So like I said, not speaking up in live chat, but also Andy's like one of my most trusted friends of all time, for real. No joke. Like I can tell you folks, out of all, I've got to give you credit, Andy. This is going to be sentimental for everybody to see this. And I know this puts you on the spot. I'm sorry, but I have to be honest. Andy really is. You really are one of the most loyal friends I've ever had. And you've just always been so easygoing. And I just am so thankful that you've never held a grudge either. Because I can be quite annoying, but you've always been so gracious. So, but we have a super chat coming in from Cillian Holland says, since you've run out of questions, Sean, can you supply one study that shows evidence for the poverty gene? Let's see. I am so sorry that they must be watching on, you know, when you know how you can like, while you watch a live stream, you can like pull back the time meter. So they must be behind. They must be 20 minutes like 20 minutes backwards into the stream in terms of where they're listening right now. So if you hear this, Cillian, I'm so sorry that I got your super chat too late because the debate's already wrapped up. But let's see. Conservative non-believer says, hello all. Thanks for coming by. And then Alien says, will you host a debate? In parentheses, which animal is better for domestic use, cow or goat? Oh, that's an interesting question. It depends. It honestly really does depend. It frankly, because that topic is a risky topic with our audience might be like, I'm not really into that. It would depend on, for example, if it was PewDiePie and Mr. Beast that wanted to debate it, we'd obviously host it. But and it wouldn't have to be that, you know, they wouldn't have to be PewDiePie and Mr. Beast. But I mean, my point is just that it's a topic that's risky, to be honest. I don't know if the audience would go for it, but we are open-minded. So I don't know, like if you're really thinking deeply on it, email me. But also Felix Night Owl, thanks for coming by. Says, has the debate already happened? It has, Felix. It already wrapped up. It was a fast one tonight. This is one of the faster ones we've had in a while. And then Surgeon General, thanks for all of your work. Thanks for your being a moderator. And Hannah Anderson, thanks for being a moderator. Appreciate that. Tyler, good to see you there in the old live chat. I see you there. Thanks for all of your work, mods. You do a fantastic job. Mark Madsen, thanks for coming by. We are going to take off, but want to say thanks, everybody. We love you guys. Seriously, it's been so encouraging. This channel has been it's been so fun, and it always is fun. And we've got a new debate coming up. Stefan Molyneux has agreed to debate we'll just say this. It's going to be a big one. So keep an eye out as we are excited for that. And then you don't want to miss it. I am pumped about that. So thanks very much. We really do appreciate you guys. We hope you have a great rest of your night. And thanks again, Andy, for your help. Oh, you're on mute, Andrew.
Oh, sorry. I didn't realize I was on mute. All right. Thank you, James. Thank you, everyone. Have a good night.
You. Appreciate you, Andy. Oh, one second. Twitch, what? I'm so sorry. Twitch, I have to say hi to Twitch. I'm sorry, folks. I forgot to say hi to you. I forgot, like, in the last, like, 45 minutes, I forgot to jump into the Twitch chat. Twitch chat, good to see you. Topazzle, thanks for coming by. Glad you were with us, as well as Surgeon General 777. Thanks for dropping in. And says, James is looking super beta tonight. Thanks so much. That's funny. I really do work on being as beta looking as I can with these suit jackets and the glasses. I don't know. What do you guys think? But Brooke Sparrow, good to see you in the old live chat. Holy Squirrel, Surgeon General, thanks, everybody. Thanks to Potzel for all of your guys' help and support of the channel. Seriously, we love you guys. I hope you have a great rest of your night, and we'll see you tomorrow, actually. We've got to get the event up. We're having a debate. Red Eagle Politics et al. Red Eagle Politics and others are going to be on tomorrow night. It's going to be juicy. I was supposed to make the thumbnail, but I'm going to work on it. So I want to say thanks.
I think it's Red Eagle Politics and David Carlson against Zach and Gavin from the Vanguard.
It's going to be amazing. So you don't want to miss it. I'm pumped. And thanks, Andy, for that. But yes, thanks, everybody. We hope you have a great rest of your night. Keep sifting out the reasonable from the unreasonable, and we'll see you next time.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.